Welcome to the Behaviorist Book Club. We are a community of practitioners focused on helping your clients achieve meaningful and socially significant behavior change. This is your host, Matt Harrington.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Behaviorist Book Club. It's definitely been a hot second. I took another little bit of time away from the podcast. As life tends to happen, it happened really fast for me. But now we're in a new spot, we're in a new space, I have a new job, and I think this is going to be a much easier, more settled time for me personally, which translates into consistency with the podcast. So I might go and do another episode on what it's like to job search in behavior analysis, because I have switched jobs a few times now, and what are my tips and tricks in terms of finding a new position and really finding out if it's a solid place you want to lay your feet down at. But for now, let's focus on what you probably came here for, which is behavior analysis article reviews and summaries. Without further ado, let's continue on with that. This article comes from Behavior Analysis in Practice. It was published in 2023, and the title is Examination of Ethical Decision-Making Models Across Disciplines, Common Elements and Applications to the Field of Behavior Analysis by Suarez and colleagues. I wanted to start with this because, one, I think it's really important to always put our ethics and our decision-making models up front, because it's something that while we go through the craziness of behavior plans and treatments and revising interventions and doing caregiver trainings, it sometimes gets lost in the sauce to actually have a really solid ethical decision-making model until you get to the point where it's too late to use your decision-making model. We'll talk about this later on, but the first thing that you have to do within all of these models is identify if there's a problem and address it clearly and succinctly first before it grows into a bigger problem. And oftentimes we just get too busy and we forget to identify those small problems before they get bigger, and then they get bigger and unmanageable, and then we have reports and things like that. I also wanted to cover this because I really love it whenever anybody from our field steps out of our field and does something with another field. Call me old-fashioned, but I just like everyone holding hands, singing kumbaya as we work together with other disciplines to provide really high quality services. So as soon as I saw that we're also going to be looking at other ethics codes from other disciplines, I was sold. This was the one I wanted to start with. So let's start where we always do, with the introduction. So the article introduces that really there have been dozens of different ethical decision-making models. This is both within our field and outside of our field. Now, most recently, the BACB put out the 2020 Ethics Code and Ethics Decision-Making Model, but in every other field, such as occupational therapy, in the MDs, in speech and language, there's also decision-making models in those fields, and there's ethics codes in there. And one thing that's important is to remember, in terms of the age of our field, we're relatively young. Maybe we're on par with occupational therapy and speech because those are both young sciences, but when you compare it to psychology, perhaps, or psychiatry, we're very young fields. Dentistry, we're a very young field compared to them. And one thing that with age comes is a lot of multiple exemplars for ethical problems. If you think about the amount of ethical issues that ABA has, you can more or less say that any other psychiatry or any other discipline that's been around for longer has exponentially more ethical issues because they've been around for exponentially longer. So it's important to pull the wisdom from those older fields. Another really good reason why it's important to go across disciplines for things like that is simple professional discourse. When we sit at the multidisciplinary table, as most conversations end up being multidisciplinary at this point, we need to be able to communicate cleanly and clearly and have common values with the other practitioners at the table. Now, oftentimes this looks like communicating with occupational therapists, primary care doctors, speech and language therapists, and when it comes to decision making, everyone having the same idea of what an ethical decision looks like and what it doesn't is going to get you past that first initial bit of, I'm not sure if, much less if this is a good decision, if this is a decision that I'd feel comfortable recommending. As I said, we also get a lot more resources for problem solving. Perhaps the Board of Psychologists puts out documentation about a specific one of their steps that is just very strong and clearly defined as a solid task analysis. Guess what? There's nothing to say that the BACB can't adopt those into our current practice as well with citing things. The final reason that I really like going outside disciplines is, of course, because we kind of circle around our biases. Now, I don't see this too much in ethical decision making because most people are pretty straightforward about the type of, at least clinically speaking, ethical decisions that need to be made. However, it's definitely important that we don't live and breathe within our echo chamber. Right? We take a step outside, we breathe, we touch grass, and then we look to other disciplines and see, hey, is this thing that is assumed to be an ethical behavior in behavior analysis, why is it that that's not ethical in another field? And when you go outside of your echo chamber and you get information from other sources and you listen first instead of just telling, you're going to be able to get a lot more information and maybe even change your own opinion. So overall, with all of the solid reasons why it's worthwhile to look at not only all the ABA systematic reviews of the ethics code and of ethic decision-making models, but also to pull in from other fields, the overall purpose of this article was to do a systematic review and look at the descriptive analysis of ethical decision-making across ABA and allied disciplines. They wanted to consolidate suggestions and come up with their own best list of ethical decision-making models. Now, this isn't designed to be the end-all be-all, and the authors make it clear that ethical decision-making evolves and changes with times, but they did want a one-stop shop where behavior analysts could come, look at the list, compare it with the BACB list, and then move on and make their decision. After a lot of selection processes and manual coding, thousands of articles, 60 articles in total across disciplines were included. They looked at any step of the decision-making process that applied in multiple places and put it in the kind of article list, if you will. This is the list that the authors came up with that consolidated from all of the 60 articles what were the common steps and the common practices. This is contrasted by the BACB, the 11-step BACB process. And so what they did is they just mapped them onto each other and they looked to see where one maybe was a little bit more descriptive than the other and where another one could maybe use some beefing up with the research that they found. So let's go through the 11-step BACB list and then the nine-step article list, and let's compare the two. So the BACB starts with clearly define the issue and consider potential risk of harm to relevant individuals. The article list has three steps within this section. They call it the ethical radar, where they identify if something doesn't feel right, an urgent detour, which is a legal or reporting issue that needs to be addressed before any other actions are taken, and then pinpoint the problem, which is specifying the exact issue. Now, to me, the article list definitely has the better description and really clarifies what this step is trying to do. As I alluded to earlier, this step is all about early identification. When you think about an ethical issue, let's say it is a learner who isn't making progress on an IEP goal because of interfering behaviors, and the people at the IEP team aren't doing anything to address the self-injurious behavior. That becomes a pretty fast ethical issue, right? Because nobody at the table is making steps to help this child get through these interfering behaviors and access learning. And on top of that, they may be causing harm to the child because they're not addressing the self-injury. as a behavior analyst or any other team member who decides to do something about this issue, if you come in 3, 4, 6 months into the school year, you're going to be faced with a very different challenge than if you came in right at the beginning. There's going to be a lot of set behavior. There's going to be a lot of resistance to change. There may even be teachers who have developed their own kind of ways of coping, and your strategies may counteract with that. So that early identification that, like, oh, something doesn't feel right, let me specify exactly what it is so I can decide if this is something that I need to act on now, I think is a really important step. Next, the BACB says identify all relevant individuals, and the article list goes on for information gathering, looking at effective parties, reference the professional code of ethics, reference other codes of ethics, and get a lot of case-specific information. Once again, the article list simply goes into a lot more details on this step, but they're both, generally speaking, saying the same thing, which is get information. If we continue with our example before for the learner who isn't making progress, let's get a real good, solid, overall look at this entire case before we start throwing around ethical violations. It's possible that the client is making progress to the IEP goals and the interfering behavior is being decreased, but the data collected isn't saying that. The data isn't indicative of that because the data is wrong or skewed or whatever reason. So let's take some time to actually look at the client in front of us, get a lot of information, talk to the teacher, talk to the other members of the multidisciplinary team, and basically get a full picture of what the potential ethical violation is. This is really important because the first thing that you need to do when you step into ethical problems is to listen. And this step is the listen step. Finally, the BACB goes through on some of their own individual steps, such as gathering relevant supporting documents, consider your own learning histories and biases, identifying the principle and the meaning of the code items, and consulting available code items. So the one I want to zoom in on is the consider your own learning history and biases. We've talked a lot about cultural humility on this podcast and in other trainings we've done, and this is essentially what it's talking about. Once again, after we listen, before we go around throwing around ethics violations, let's take a second and consider our own learning history. What are we missing, right? What is happening that we don't actually see? Or perhaps what is it that we see but we dismiss? Whose perspective are we not listening to based on our own prior biases? You got to take your time, identify that, work through it, listen to yourself and what yourself is telling you, and then objectively talk and see if you have a bias or not. A lot of cultural humility exercises are really well. We've gone over a few, but you can also do a little bit of searching and find a lot for yourself as well. Okay, after that, the BACB continues with their list, develop several possible actions to reduce and remove harm, prioritizing the best interests of the clients in accordance with the code and applicable laws. And the article list goes on, identify available options or behaviors, anything that places constraints on the behavioral alternatives. And this is, they're both saying the same thing, which is just plan. Be careful. Don't move too fast. There's a pattern here. In each of these steps, it's saying breathe, wait, think. And that's because ethical issues can be very sensitive. We'll talk about a little bit later on about the approach to take when actually having these conversations. But this is all about risk-benefit planning. You need to go in with as much information as possible so that you can properly cost-benefit analysis the next step you're going to take. For that kid we're talking about who's having self-injury, it may be a high benefit to go in with a specific intervention, but the cost may be buy-in from the rest of the IEP team. If you come in hot and heavy with a big intervention that you know is going to immediately solve the problem, is the rest of the IEP team going to feel included, or are they going to have buy-in? And long-term, is there going to be fidelity for that intervention? Probably not, because there wasn't any consulting. So what does that mean? Well, maybe you need an alternative path. Maybe you need a different pathway to get that buy-in and long-term fidelity rather than the one you were originally planning. That's the cost benefit that we're talking here. It's just thinking through and being realistic about the outcomes of what's going to happen. the BACB continues, critically evaluate each possible action by considering with its alignment within the letter and the spirit of the code, its potential impact, and the likelihood of immediately resolving the concern, as well as variables such as client preference, social acceptability, degree of restrictiveness, and likelihood of maintenance. And the article list says ranking and weighing information. Once again, reminding us to consider our biases and cultural barriers, very similar to what I just talked about, just thinking through the if-thens, the cost benefits, and looking at social acceptability, client acceptability, client preference, assent, consent, all of those different factors. BACB continues, select the action that likely is going to resolve in the most specific ethical concern being reduced and reduce the likelihood in the future. And the article says the same thing. Synthesize the above steps of the plan and implement. There we go. We've thought a lot about the ethical issue. We've gathered information. We've considered our own biases. We've looked at it from every angle. Now it's time to actually implement. The BABC continues and says, take the selected actions and document, and then both documents want you to then evaluate your decision at the end and decide if further action is needed. And that takes us to the end of the decision-making model. You'll see that in only one of those steps are we actually doing anything. In only one of those steps are we actually taking and trying to solve a problem with the behavior. Everything else is just listening and learning and getting a full picture of the situation before we do anything. And that, I think, is the most important thing to pull out of this article. This is across multiple different disciplines. The first step is to listen. The first step, and many of the other steps, is just to identify, listen, and consider. Another really interesting finding from the other disciplines is the fact that all of them, just like the BACB, have task analyses within their teaching method. So this has been an aside, it's not really purposeful for the rest of the conversation, but it's interesting that everyone uses that task analysis method in order to teach their ethics codes. It would be interesting, the authors note, to do a little bit of messing around with the order. What would happen if you did this versus that? Would you get any better result? Is there room for kind of that component analysis of the ethics code to make faster progress in solving ethical dilemmas? Maybe could be an area for future research. So overall, let's talk about not only this article, but also ethical conversations and my suggestions for moving forward and having them. This article, it did what it was designed to do. It looked at a clean ethical decision-making list, and it sourced the heck out of it. Every single one of those steps now has articles on articles from our discipline and other disciplines, as well as the BACB list. There's a lot of support and a lot of kind of resources for anybody to go if they have struggles with those conversations. So this article definitely did its job. It's a good one to review, and it's a good one to keep in your back pocket if you ever need more citations. In terms of having these conversations yourself, this is something as a behavior analyst, oh gosh, you're going to have these conversations. You're going to run into ethical issues as a behavior analyst, and it could be as small and as annoying as a billing problem. Right, your boss is overbilling 15 minutes but not talking to the insurance about it, or billing while the client's sleeping. That's a significant ethical issue, but it's not really causing the client directly any harm. It is long term and it's causing harm for the field, but it's not like there's an immediate cause of harm or risk of harm. And it could be as serious as interfering behavior is increasing in intensity and dangerousness because of actions that a behavior analyst is taking or not taking to solve the problem. And there is an immediate risk of harm, and there needs to be a immediate discharge or transfer of case to another competent behavior analyst in order to help solve that problem, or another service provider. So these really range in immediate risk of harm, but I found that there's a couple things that kind of throughout all of the situations have helped me deal with every single one of them. The first thing to think about is determine if this is a bad business decision, an annoying boss or coworker, a disagreement on maybe some values, but we're still providing solid behavior analysis, or is it an actual ethical concern. And the reason why I always suggest to start there is that there's a lot of annoying people in behavior analysis, but they're not an ethical problem, right? It's not like they're going against the ethics code. You just don't like them. And that's okay. I've not liked people. I've not liked bosses. I've not liked coworkers. But they weren't ethically a problem. They were just annoying. And making that initial differentiation is really important, because as you move through the ethical process, you realize this is a big deal. This isn't something that you approach lightly. And the way that you would solve an ethical dilemma is much different than the way you would solve a coworker problem. I had a coworker who I just didn't like. We did not click. We were not friends. We were never going to be friends. But she wasn't an ethical issue. Like, it wasn't something where she was engaging in unethical behavior. And so what I did is I just avoided her, because she's a coworker and I can do that. There was no risk of harm. There was no risk of having an ethical issue with this person. So I just avoided her, and that solved the problem. But you can't do that if it's an ethical issue. First, identify it's an actual ethical concern, and then take the appropriate steps if it's not. Maybe that's separation from the company. Maybe that's not seeing a coworker. Maybe that's communicating only over email, regardless of what it might be. Once you determine that it's an actual ethical issue, we always need to approach that first conversation where we broach the ethical topic with a lot of care. I found that the best thing is a lot of humility and a lot of questioning. We did gather tons of information and consider tons of different actions, but we never got the person's perspective. So approach the person, have a conversation with them with a lot of humility and questions, and consider that your ultimate finale of your information gathering stage before you turn around and start insisting that solutions need to occur. Because there are more, and there could be unforeseen environmental barriers to some of the solutions that you've already thought of. There could be reasons that you may not see that then make this not an ethical issue, such as prior learning for the client or medical issues or things like that. There could be a lot happening behind the scenes that you may not directly see, but it could still be a cut and dry ethical issue. We just don't know. Always take the perspective, walk into that conversation with a lot of humility, a lot of questioning, asking, hey, let's talk more about this. Can you tell me why? Oh, that's interesting that you made that decision. I probably would have went a different way. Why do you think we're off target on that? And trying to find as much as possible about this specific situation before you flow in with your cost benefit and your decision-making model. Everyone, we went a little bit longer, but that's okay, because heck, you guys deserve it after not hearing from me for quite a few months. So I guess we'll end it there. And I'll remind you that if you want to continue supporting, the best thing you can do is just giving us a like or a favorite or a download wherever you're listening, and then giving us that 5-star review or lower if you feel up to it. Well, thank you so much for listening, and I will see you in the next one. So there you have it. That's the end of our podcast. It would mean the world to me if you commented or shared, or whoever you're interacting with this content, subscribe if you're on a podcast platform. It means the world to me. And also, if you're available, give a review to this podcast. Give it 5 stars if you love it. Give me feedback if not. I read every single one, and it does a ton to boost the visibility of content like this in the overall algorithm. If you want to continue engaging with the Behaviorist Book Club, the best place to go is the ABA Cafe Facebook group. You can find it just by typing in the ABA Cafe into your Facebook search bar. It is a group of research-minded practitioners engaging and collaborating together to become better behavior analysts through our application of practitioner-focused research. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you in the next one.